Here on Stolen Lives, we discuss brutal and heartbreaking crimes against children. Themes may include child murder, torture, and sexual, domestic and child abuse. I do try my best to remain respectful for the babies in these stories and leave out unnecessary details that honestly, none of us need to know to understand the frustration of why and how this ever happened. However, if you find any of these themes triggering, this podcast may not be for you. Listener discretion is advised. Before we begin this week's episode, a little bit of housekeeping. About 18 months ago, I lost my Patreon to some lovely hackers who helped themselves to my account. Long story short, my Patreon was deleted. I have restarted my Patreon, but this time I've decided to keep it completely free moving forward. I want it to be more of a community space for the podcast. There won't be any ad-free episodes, but I will post additional photos and case notes, as well as updates on previous episodes. If you'd still like to support the show financially, I've created an Amazon wish list full of books. This podcast takes a lot out of me, and I've found reading has really helped my mental health. As a thank you, anyone who purchases a book from my wish list can leave a note with a case suggestion, and I'll prioritise covering it within the next 3 months, as well as give you a shout out on the episode. Now, of course, financially supporting the podcast is never expected. Listening, sharing episodes, commenting, and just being here as a support genuinely helps more than you know. I will place a link to the Patreon and the Amazon wishlist in the show notes. Late 1980s, Melbourne, Australia. A masked attacker preyed on young girls, and he has still not been identified to this day. It's believed that he is responsible for a dozen attacks during his reign of terror that maybe ended with the murder of a teenage schoolgirl. This is the story of the victims of the unknown Australian serial abductor and murderer, Mr. Cruel.
Carmen has been missing from her Templestowe home for nearly 48 hours. The hooded kidnapper, armed with a knife, burst into the luxury Circles Road home.
Further threats to the Chan family can be seen right on their front lawn. A red Toyota sedan attacked with spray can graffiti last night. Across the windscreen, the words "payback," and more ominously along the side, "more to come."
It is my daughter! Oh, my family and family lover! Don't spoil my family, please!
Saturday, August 27th, 1987, in the Melbourne suburb of Lower Plenty, 4 a.m. An unknown man uses a brick to break a lounge room window of a family home. He removes the glass and enters. He's wearing a black balaclava, a brown tweed jacket, and yellow rubber gloves. The sight would have been absolutely terrifying. This man did not come empty-handed. He had packed 4 sets of handcuffs, a red and white nylon cord, electrical tape, and surgical tape. He also was armed with a knife and a handgun. This man wanted to make his presence known too. He entered the parents' bedroom, and as he walked in, they wake up, obviously surprised to find this strange man in their home. They don't know what is going on, and there would have been an immediate concern about the children, especially after this man threatens to harm the kids if the parents make any noise. The man handcuffs the parents, their hands and their feet. He covers their eyes with the surgical tape. He gags them. And again, the terror in these parents, knowing they have been completely immobilized. And here is this maniac walking around the house where your children are innocently sleeping, and you cannot do anything to protect them. The man next went to the room of the 6-year-old boy and ties him to his bed. He then ties the hands of the 12-year-old girl, and that's everyone in the family. This is when the man returned to the parents' room, and he tells them that all he wants is money. He actually removes the handcuffs and instead restrains them using the nylon cord, moving the couple to the wardrobe, where he locks them in there. While they are locked away, they hear a phone call the man is making on the family phone, and what he is saying was frightening. It sounded as if he was threatening a child, so obviously they were listening in and trying to figure out exactly what was going on and the man's motives. Now, later in the police investigation, the detectives would determine there was never actually a phone call. Phone records would show no call incoming or outgoing at this time. It was entirely faked to instill fear in this family. After this, the true target of this home invasion becomes clear. The man went back into the 12-year-old girl's bedroom and he takes her into the bathroom. He forces her to brush and floss her teeth. He turns on the radio to a loud volume to drown out any cries, and then he rapes her. The man then isn't satisfied with completely stripping this family of ever feeling comfortable and safe in their home again, but he then goes into the kitchen and cooks himself a meal, really taking his time. After this, he went back into the bathroom and assaulted the 12-year-old girl again. He would spend 2 hours in the family home before leaving around 6 a.m. But before that, he cuts the phone lines and cleans up the glass from the broken window. He also stole some personal items, some clothing, an engagement ring, and a record set of the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Just before he left, he takes the girl he had been assaulting and tied her ankles, telling her to count down from 100 before doing anything. Now this girl had already been through so much. She didn't wait any longer than she had to get her parents, her safety. As soon as she heard the man leave, she just runs to her parents' room to untie them. Now they call the police immediately, and a description of the man is given, that he was aged in his 30s, standing around 175 centimetres or 5'7". That he had brown hair and was of slim build, that he had a deep, gravelly voice. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. Almost a year and a half after this attack, December 27th, 1988, Ringwood, Melbourne, the Wills family arrived home around 10 p.m. Julie Wills and the children go to bed pretty much straight away. It is just after Christmas and it's getting late and everyone is overtired. For whatever reason, he couldn't sleep, and he is just watching TV until 10 to 5 in the morning. During this time, it's believed Mr. Krill was watching the home until the lights went out. I only imagine that was to get the upper hand, because it would be much easier to lose control of the situation if the man of the house is awake and alert. Because he wouldn't make his move until 30 minutes later, when it was likely that John was asleep. Armed with a knife and a handgun, the unknown man gains entry into the home via the back door. He does this by sliding the newspaper beneath the door and then pushing the key out of the lock. When it drops down, he pulls it out with the newspaper and unlocks the door. New fear realised, I'm never leaving a key in a lock again. Again, he is wearing a black balaclava with white stitching around the holes for the eyes and mouth. Honestly, if you've seen sketches of this mask, it will haunt your dreams. I will try to remember to post these sketches on the Patreon. This man enters the parents' bedroom, and Julie wakes up and he's literally pointing a gun at her. Now, obviously, she reacts how I think every parent who listens to this podcast would react. You forget about what happens to you, and all you can think about is getting your children to safety. Julie screams out for the kids to get out of the house. What the man does next is put the gun to John's head and kind of challenges him to do something. But obviously John doesn't want to put his family's lives at risk, so he does nothing. The man binds both John and Julie with copper wire and he gags them. At first he demands money, which I mean in the grand scheme of things, material items and money can be replaced, so take what you want. After this, the man enters the room of John and Julie's daughter, 10-year-old Sharon Wills. And she is sleeping on the top of a bunk bed. Now this man literally says her name to wake her up. And this has contributed to theories over the years, that this man could have known the family or had been stalking them for a time to know their names, their home and routines. Sharon is already awake. She'd heard her mother's scream but was frozen with fear. And I am sure we can all remember being a child and being scared, and the solution for that is just to hide way underneath your blankets. And this is what Sharon had done. But this monster just shines a flashlight in Sharon's face and orders her to get out of bed. And while she's doing that, he's taking several of her clothing items, packing them to take them. He puts tape over her eyes and one of her father's jackets over her shoulders, and he carries her outside to his vehicle. Sharon just starts screaming. She is such a brave little girl to fight back at this point. She knows that the best chance she has right now is to make as much noise as possible. But this man is prepared, and he places a ball gag into the girl's mouth and he abducts her. He had been in the home for less than 10 minutes, which is a huge escalation here. Sharon's parents freed themselves and call emergency services to report what had happened. 10-year-old Sharon Wills is taken to a property and leashed to a bed. She is repeatedly sexually assaulted, and that would be her existence for the next excruciating 18 hours. After this point, Sharon is released in the grounds of Bayswater High School. She is found by a woman and her daughter, wrapped in green bin bags and her father's shirt. These bin bags were actually around her head, with an eye and breathing hole cut out. Now, authorities would check these bin bags for forensic evidence, and here is the theme for this entire story. There was no evidence. There was an absence of DNA and fingerprint evidence, so the perpetrator here is very aware of what could incriminate him. But what we are also seeing here is a massive escalation of crimes, and I'm sure what would be a concern here was a potential loss of life. Because what we started with was a few hours in the family home, and now here we have an actual abduction of 18 hours. Police would speak with Sharon, and she was able to reveal some pretty crucial details about the man who abducted her. She told the investigators the attacker made her shower and brush and floss her teeth, and this is what happened to the first girl that was assaulted. After he brutally assaulted Sharon, he made her shower again and wash thoroughly. And this would be to remove any possible forensic evidence. But not only that, but he made her cut her nails and she was blindfolded the entire time, so she couldn't identify him. Sharon was given food and drink during her captivity. And at one point he even left her alone in the property. At that point, Sharon lifted her blindfold, and she saw what appeared to be a camera and tripod at the foot of the bed. Which only adds to how sinister this all is, because it's then likely some of the assault had been videoed or photos had been taken. This just takes this disgusting crime and just adds another layer of evil to it all. Sharon was also able to give some details about the attacker's vehicle. She said it sounded like an old car, that she also noticed the interior carpet and trims were cream. And what would come out with later eyewitness reports was a white Commodore Vacationer sedan had been seen in the area around the time that Sharon was left at the high school. The witness said the car was driving with its lights off, and they almost crashed into it, but that the driver was seemingly trying to hide their face, strongly suggesting to investigators that this was their guy. Two brothers would also report to police of seeing a suspicious-looking man filming the Wills family about 6 weeks before Sharon was abducted, which again is terrifying, knowing that he'd been stalking the family, tracking their routines for weeks before this all went down. The boy said that when the man noticed they were watching him, he quickly made his exit, describing him as being aged to his early to mid-30s. He was balding with brown hair and had a pot belly. And this somewhat matched what the Wills family thought as well. John and Julie told police they thought the intruder to be around 5'8 to 5'9, or 175 to 180 centimetres tall. Late 20s to early 30s, and well spoken. Now, police immediately theorised that the attack in Lower Plenty and Sharon's abduction were linked. The MO was just too similar for them not to have been carried out by one and the same predator. They were meticulously planned, and according to the families terrorised here, they described him as being really calm throughout the entire ordeal. The Sun newspaper was the first to refer to him as being super cool and super cruel, and that's how he was given the moniker Mr. Cruel. And it wouldn't be long before Mr. Cruel would strike again. July 3rd, 1990, Canterbury, Melbourne. The last week of school term before it would be the start of winter break. The Linus family were due to leave the home they were renting at 10 Mammouth Avenue the next day. This is a very prestigious middle-upper-class neighbourhood and considered completely safe. The parents Brian and Rosemary were out for the evening, enjoying a rare date night out. They were leaving to return to England in a few days, and it was somewhat of a farewell dinner, leaving at home their daughters, 15-year-old Fiona and 13-year-old Nicola. These girls were responsible. They had some delivery pizza and went to bed around 11 p.m. A half an hour later, 11:30 p.m, the man breaks into the home, obviously seeing the lights go off and realising this is his moment. He is again armed with a knife and a gun. He's wearing the balaclava, forcing out the window in the parents' bedroom, and he walks into the room where the girls were sleeping. At that point, Nicola wakes up to the tapping of a knife blade to her head. He threatens her life. The man forces the girls into their parents' bedroom and demands money, before telling the sisters to lie on the bed. He hog ties Fiona with wire, and then takes Nicola into the kitchen and starts stealing insignificant items. While he does this, he orders Nicola to get her school uniform and then ties her up. He gags her. He places tape over the terrified little girl's eyes. He cuts the phone lines. He takes the family's car keys and tells Nicola he's going to demand a $25,000 ransom for her return. The man orders Nicola to sit on the floor of the front passenger seat in the footwell. He tells her that if she sees his face, he will kill her. When they reach their destination, he makes Nicola thoroughly wash and brush her teeth. The man then ties her to the bed. But this time, he falls asleep next to her. The anxiety Nicola must have been feeling. He was delaying the terror, but it also shows the restraint and control Mr. Krull had throughout all of these situations. Every move was thought through and planned meticulously. The ultimate power play. The next morning, he forces Nicola to dress in a school uniform and tells her that he has this schoolgirl fantasy, and then he just repeatedly sexually assaults her. Now, he does give her food and water like he did Sharon, but I feel this situation has escalated again. He then gets Nicola to thoroughly wash before again continuing on with the assault. And throughout these assaults, he calls her Missy and Nikki, and these happen to be the nicknames only those closest to Nicola use. So that's next level here. He is letting her know that he knows her, but she doesn't know him, only further breaking her, having her question everyone she trusts. Nicola would later recount to police that during her time with Mr. Krull, he kept the radio on, and this is something all his victims would report. At one point, he actually watched the press conference where Nicola's parents are making this emotional plea for their daughter's safe return. And according to Nicola, he seemed to enjoy seeing their suffering. He was loving the attention. He keeps Nicola for 50 hours, after which he makes her wash herself thoroughly, brush her teeth, get changed into different clothes, always very aware of forensic evidence. And then he covers her eyes with tape and wraps her in a bedsheet. In the early morning hours, he walks Nicola through the streets for several minutes, before finally releasing her at an electrical substation in Kew. It's around 2 a.m. Nicola manages to find her way to a nearby house to ask for help. All she wanted was her parents. Nicola was able to give a description of the man who attacked her, that he was Caucasian, that he was aged between 30 to 50 years old, around 170 centimetres tall or 5'7", solid build with a bit of a belly, that he had a gruff Australian accent. And here we're seeing a consistent description of the man developing. Something that I can imagine was an invaluable piece of evidence. But Nicola said that during her captivity, she could hear planes flying low, meaning where she was being held was on a flight path, close to the airport. Now, despite having a consistent description and a possible general vicinity of where he was keeping these girls after they were abducted, police had no forensic evidence. They had no suspects. There would have been so much frustration here for the authorities, but the investigation was at a standstill. 9 months later, April 13th, 1991, Templestowe, 8:40 p.m. And this is the first day of school break for Easter. A man wearing a balaclava and armed with a knife breaks into the Chan family home. Parents John and Phyllis, they are working at a Chinese restaurant that they owned, just 10 minutes away from their home. They had left their eldest child, 13-year-old Carmen, to look after her two younger siblings, 9-year-old Carly and 7-year-old Karen. The intruder breaks in and threatens the children with a knife he is carrying. He takes Carly and Karen and locks them in the cupboard, barricading the door with a bed. He then abducts Carmen, forcing her at knife point to walk to a nearby vacant block where the car was waiting. And this would be the last time anyone would see Carmen alive. Following the abduction, Carmen's parents John and Phyllis speak at a press conference, begging for their little girl to be given back to them. During this press conference, the police also announce they believe that Mr. Krull was responsible for Carmen's disappearance. And because of that, there would be the belief behind the scenes that the same pattern as the earlier crimes would follow. And in a day or two, Carmen be found wandering, terrified and forever psychologically scarred, but otherwise okay. But she would return home and her parents could work on healing her. That wouldn't be the case here. And a few days became a week, and then months went by. It wouldn't be until a year later that Carmen would be found, April 9th, 1992. A dog walker discovered Carmen's badly decomposed body. She had been buried in a shallow grave near a landfill site at Thomastown in Melbourne, just behind an electrical substation. A memorial was later created at this spot by Carmen's parents as a way to honour their sweet daughter. Now, obviously, because a year has passed, the autopsy was a challenge for the medical examiner, but they were able to determine that Carmen died by 3 gunshot wounds to the head, and this was suspected to occur shortly after her abduction. This changed the entire investigation because now a child had been murdered. However, again, the police had no leads and no suspects. Something else that was a shift from the previous cases was the abductor had actually vandalised the Chan vehicle. Spray painted on the night of the abduction was "Payback Asian Drug Dealer." Again, this was thought to have been Mr. Krill's way of taunting the family. Another power play, because there was never any indication the Chans were involved in drugs. They were a hard-working, law-abiding, good family. Unfortunately, as with the previous crimes, there was no forensic evidence available. No fingerprints, no DNA. However, thanks to witness accounts, there were reports of a man in a sedan that had been watching Carmen's private school bus stop that was opposite her house on a number of occasions. Aside from this, days before Carmen's abduction, her parents had deactivated the house alarm because something had kept setting it off. And this suggests that perhaps Mr. Krill had been stalking the home, seeing if there was any blind spots where he could avoid the home security system and enter the home undetected. Perhaps he had tried to break in before the night of Carmen's abduction, setting off the house alarm. There were also other crimes throughout Melbourne that investigators also considered at this time may be attributable to Mr. Krill, because the description of the perpetrator and the crimes themselves just seemed too eerily similar, even if it had been against a different age group. But perhaps it was leading up to the crimes we know Mr. Krill best for. There were reports of a man breaking into a home of a 90-year-old nun. He raped her and held her captive, before driving the woman to a bank, forcing her to get her money out of an ATM machine. He told her he wanted to steal her life savings. And then in February 1985, a 14-year-old girl was abducted from her home in Hampton. During the sexual assault here, the attacker told this little girl, quote, "My liberty, my freedom is more important than your life," unquote. The authorities set up a task force, Spectrum, and their job was to look at all these different crimes that played out over a 10-year period. They examined 30,000 houses and 27,000 persons of interest. There were posters made up with the details of the abductions. These would be distributed to 1.4 million homes. That is an absolute crazy amount of police work going on here. The fact this serial offender has never been apprehended has nothing to do with lazy police work, because they really put in 110% here to try and bring justice to the families involved, as well as bringing some element of safety back into the community. Because there would have been so much fear here, waiting for Mr. Krill to strike again. And it could basically happen to anyone. He was targeting good kids from good families and good neighbourhoods. At this time, no suspect would be identified. The FBI was involved in sharing their expertise, and a criminal profile was developed. It was believed the suspect was most likely from the area where the crimes were committed. He was believed to be considered a polite, friendly man, possibly with an eye for detail, an introvert, someone who was active in the local community, possibly volunteering for local clubs or sporting teams where he could have access to children. That the attacker most likely worked in education, as these crimes occurred during school break, giving him more flexibility to commit his crimes and torment his victims. Detectives who had been involved with the Mr. Krill investigation suspect that he may have worked in the area of forensics, or someone who had done some sort of study into this field. However, I think that isn't necessarily true, and I think that could cause some tunnel vision if that was the only line of thinking. I mean, my 14-year-old daughter understands trace evidence and how to avoid leaving your DNA behind at a crime scene. Police believe Mr. Krill could be responsible for as many as 12 unsolved sex attacks on women and children throughout Melbourne, starting in the mid-1980s until as late as 2010 or 2013. We are just going to take a quick break now for a word from one of our sponsors. In 2010, a new task force, Apollo, was established. And they actually went back and re-examined these crimes, and they were able to identify a similar pattern of offending. Like, yes, some elements did change, from women to children, but a lot of the important factors remained consistent throughout all the crimes. Now, even though I said earlier police did all they could to solve this case, there were some later sloppy mistakes. There was lost evidence, including the tape that Mr. Krill used to tie up one of his victims. And with all these advancements in forensic testing, maybe it held a piece of crucial evidence that could have led to a potential suspect. In 2016, the reward money was raised to $1 million Australian dollars. Police also released a 1994 dossier named the Sierra Files. These were given to the Herald Sun newspaper, and this contained vital information that had never been previously made public. These files spoke of 7 possible suspects, including a prime suspect. Investigators did mention they tried to contact these suspects with varying degrees of success. The prime suspect mentioned was now 77-year-old Brian Allen Elkner, a serial violent sex offender and a former university lecturer. He had been in jail before. In 1974, he'd served 10 years for various sexual assaults. Elkner would break into victims' homes armed with a knife, all very similar to Mr. Krill. It would also be revealed in court that he would have these sexual fantasies of raping young women and girls. And he was released from jail not long before the Mr. Krill attacks began. It was also revealed that a knife and a balaclava were found in Elkner's home during a police search. However, despite all of this, Elkner has never been charged with the Mr. Krill crimes, and he has maintained his innocence. Besides the circumstantial evidence, there really is nothing that suggests that Brian Elkner is Mr. Krill. During a 2016 interview, Elkner stated that he had done his time and lives a reformed life, that he has a new family and worked as a writer, that he was retired and was living in France. April 2018, a somewhat interesting but also far-fetched in my opinion, but that Mr. Krill and the Golden State Killer were one and the same. Now, the Golden State Killer was a serial killer, rapist and burglar who operated in the United States. He was arrested in April 2019 for his horrendous crime sprees that continued from 1974 to 1986. Now, Joseph James D'Angelo, allegedly stopping this crime spree in 1986, fits well with the alleged start of the Mr. Krill crimes around the same time. The Victorian Police and the San Francisco Police actually compared notes on each of their investigations, under the potential theory of the Golden State Killer fleeing to Australia to continue his spree. The two criminals allegedly took meal breaks in the middle of their crimes. They were both armed with a gun and a knife. They both pretended to have fake conversations with people. They both used expert knots to tie up their victims. And they both claimed they were there to rob their victims of money. Both wore balaclavas. Okay, so there are a lot of similarities going on here. And D'Angelo actually lived in Australia at one point. In 1967, he served on the USS Canberra during a tour of duty in North Vietnam. Now, there is no real evidence that Mr. Krill and the Golden State Killer were the same person. It really is just speculation and internet fodder. Law enforcement have said that this theory is highly unlikely. 2023 was the last update in the case. It is now believed Mr. Krill may be linked to Melbourne's electrical industry. So using the latest of forensic technology and based on this theory, they mapped out locations of interest, linking all the similarities between the abductions of the 3 main victims. They were abducted or released near electrical substations. All 3 of the victims lived nearby substations, and Carmen's body was found near a substation. Also importantly, Carmen and Nicola attended the same school, which was close to a substation. Also quite of interest is that Carmen Chan's murder was the last crime that has been attributed to Mr. Krill. But then the question has to be, why would he suddenly stop offending? Why would he literally just disappear and stop abducting children? And there are a number of reasons why this would be. Maybe he's dead. We can only hope. Maybe he is in prison, the next best option. Or maybe he is still at large. Maybe he just moved to a new hunting ground. Maybe he was interviewed by the police during the original investigation, and he realised that he was getting very close to the edge of being discovered, and he stopped. Maybe he altered his victim type. Finally, it would be amiss of me if I didn't mention another case that is mentioned in discussions about Mr. Krull, and that's the disappearance of Melbourne schoolgirl, 13-year-old Bung Siriboon. Now, I have already discussed Bung's abduction back in episode 251, so if you want to hear about Bung's story, I do recommend you listen to that episode. Bung went missing in 2011 on her way to school, so this already stands out because it's sometime after Mr. Krull's last attributed crime. And it was quite different to the MO of Mr. Krull. He didn't break into the family home. He simply abducted her basically at her school gates. The only similarities here is Bung was 13, the same age as Carmen. They were fairly similar in appearance, and all of his victims were from Melbourne. There has been no solid evidence to really connect Bung to Mr. Krull, and both these cases remain unsolved. If you have your own thoughts and theories on the story we discussed today, or any stories we talk about here on Stolen Lives, please search Stolen Lives Podcast on Facebook, like the page so you don't miss an episode, and join the Stolen Lives discussion group to talk about your thoughts and theories. You can also talk to us on Instagram, Stolen Lives Podcast. If you like what you heard today, we would appreciate it if you share this episode on your social media of choice. And subscribe and leave a positive review on your podcast app. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Ali. Hosting and production was also by me, Ali. Music is by Mayu.